University of California, Santa Cruz, where she's a feminist studies professor. She's the co-author with Angela Davis, Erica Miners, and Beth Ritchie of the book Abolition, Feminism Now. The transcript of this conversation is one of 12 interviews with abolitionists included in my new book, Talking About Abolition, A Police-Free World is Possible, just published by Seven Stories Press. I'm Sonali Kohan.
You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
New year, new KBOO! Thank you to everyone who contributed and supported us during our KBOO Fights Back end of year campaign. With your support, we exceeded our $75,000 goal. Now, back to our regularly scheduled grassroots, independent, community radio.
Support for KBOO comes from its members and from Silverton People for Peace and Silverton Grange. Presenting the 23rd Silverton MLK Observance on Monday, January 19th at 6 p.m. The event will include a community potluck, a keynote speech by PCUN Director Rania Lopez, sing-alongs, and poetry readings relevant to Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s mission of social justice. More info available at grange.org.
1, 2, 3, 4. Y'all ready for this?
Ladies and
peace and blessings, good people. You are tuned into Hard Knock Radio, broadcasting across the Pacifica Radio Network. I'm your guest host, Kalonji Changa, guarding the post today for the legendary Davey D. Now, don't worry, Davey's out there doing what he does best. He's on the ground shaking hands, kissing babies, and spreading the gospel to Hard Knock Radio with the masses. We know he's holding it down wherever he is, but today we've got a massive show lined up for you. As always, this production is brought to you by the hardest working producer in the game, the amazing Anita Johnson. Today, we are diving deep into geopolitical earthquake occurring in the Horn of Africa. The headline is Somaliland, recognition worth a new Israeli outpost on the Red Sea. Just 10 days after Israel became the first country to officially recognize Somaliland's independence, Israeli Foreign Minister Gideon Saar has touchdown in Hargeisa. While Somaliland celebrates a three-decade dream of sovereignty, the international community is sounding the alarm. Is this a humanitarian breakthrough for a long-suffering people or a strategic chess move that risks a regional explosion? Joining us to peel back the layers of history and empire is none other than Professor Gerald Horn. Dr. Gerald Horn is a prolific scholar and one of the most visionary historians of our time. Dr. Horn has authored over 30 books, including The Counter-Revolution of 1776 and The Dawning of the Apocalypse. His work focuses extensively on the intersection of racism, labor, and international geopolitics. Dr. Horn provides a peerless global perspective on how the struggles of the African diaspora are linked to the machinations of global superpowers. Thank you for joining us, Dr. Horn. How are you today?
Fine, thank you for inviting me.
Always an honor, always a pleasure. It's a lot going on, as you know. There's always a lot going on. Whenever we talk, there's tons going on because, you know, we're under empire. I wanted to pose a few questions. I know you have written extensively about how the ghosts of empire haunt modern borders. Given Somaliland was a British protectorate, while Somalia was Italian, how did these distinct colonial administrative styles lay the groundwork for the 1991 separation?
Well, I think it's important to understand that that colonial backstory that you mentioned is essential to understanding the present crisis. In some ways, it reminds me of the separation between Eritrea and Ethiopia. Recall that Eritrea on the Red Sea had been colonized by the Italians, and the Ethiopians, or the Abyssinians as they were then called, were able to repel an Italian invasion in the 1890s, a turning point in the history of Pan-African struggle. Likewise, as you mentioned, what happens is that in about 1960, the two former colonies come together as one nation, Somalia. But what happens a few decades later is that under the leadership of the Mogadishu-based leader Siad Barre, the government in Somalia gets caught up in the Cold War. What I mean is, up until that point, Somalia had been pursuing what might be called a non-capitalist path of development. But it was induced and enticed to attack neighboring Ethiopia after Ethiopia had overthrown His Imperial Majesty, known to us as Haile Selassie. This is in 1974. And they were enticed to attack the post-Selassie regime, not least because of a territorial dispute over the Ogaden, or the Ogaden Desert, for example. And therein lies the descent of Somalia into a certain kind of chaos. What happens, of course, is that Somaliland decides to break away after Somalia itself begins to spiral downward. And it has not received diplomatic recognition until this point, when Israel has decided to recognize Somaliland, not least because Somaliland is strategically sited across the Red Sea from Yemen. Recall that during the post-October 7, 2023 war in historic Palestine, Gaza, etc., that Yemen, Ansar Allah, to be more precise, in Yemen, was one of the few nations to militantly rush to the defense of the beleaguered and besieged Gazans. That is to say that the folks who were referred to popularly on this side of the Atlantic as the Houthis began to shoot missiles into Israel, effectively shutting down the Israeli port that is Eilat. And that obviously grabbed the attention of the Israeli authorities. And needless to say, shortly after, a kind of ceasefire, because of course the war continues, but what has been dubbed the ceasefire has descended in Gaza. You see that the Israelis implement diplomatic relations. Now, this has been roundly denounced by Somalia itself, the Mogadishu-based regime, denounced by Egypt, denounced by the Arab League, denounced by a number of European countries, not necessarily by the United States of America, so stay tuned with regard to that, although don't be surprised if the United States tails after Israel. What's striking in this regard is that Ethiopia has been rather ambivalent about Somaliland, because right before the Israeli recognition, Ethiopia which has sought an outlet to the sea ever since the secession of Eritrea some decades ago, moved to broker an agreement with Somaliland for access to the Somaliland port of Berbera, for example. Now, this should also be put in the context of the spiraling downward descent of what's happening in Yemen. As a matter of fact, what's happening in Yemen across the Red Sea, as aforementioned, is eerily reminiscent of Venezuela. What do I mean by that? What I mean is that the United Arab Emirates, which, by the way, has been collaborating with Israel with regard to the Abraham Accords, also with regard to these machinations around Somaliland, has been sponsoring a faction in Yemen opposed by Saudi Arabia. What happened in the past week is that the Saudis invited these UAE-backed forces to talks in Riyadh, the Saudi capital, but since they've arrived, they have not been heard from. In other words, there's apparently been a de facto abduction, not unlike what befell Mr. Maduro, President Maduro, in Caracas on January 3rd. And this may be inaugurating an enhanced trend. I won't say a new trend, because in the 19th century, that kind of tactic was routine, particularly in North America. I know that you're broadcasting from KPFA, and those in your audience might be familiar with the so-called MODOC War, M-O-D-O-C, of Northern California and Southern Oregon in the 1860s, 1870s, when the MODOC leader was invited for peace talks by the U.S. authorities and, of course, was abducted. So this is part of this dangerous trend. And I would be remiss if I failed to connect what's going on in the Horn of Africa in Somalia to contemporaneous events in Minneapolis, a current hotspot. Because as we know, the U.S. authorities have flooded Minneapolis with ICE agents, Immigration and Custom Enforcement agents, who, as you know, murdered Renee Nicole Good just a few days ago, which has led to the apt slogan of ICE out of Minnesota for good, for example. And this is tied to the fact that Minneapolis is the home of a substantial population of Somali Americans, Somali immigrants. They've been accused of engaging in welfare fraud, which caused the governor, Tim Walz, Kamala Harris's running mate, to drop out of his reelection bid for governor. They're being rounded up as we speak by masked ICE agents. There is a reign of terror being inflicted upon the Somali-based community in the Twin Cities, that is to say Minneapolis and St. Paul. And so we see that there are resonances of what's going on in the Horn of Africa that are stretching across the Atlantic all the way to the U.S. Midwest.
Wow, I definitely appreciate you making that connection. I mean, it's, you know, one would say the world is on fire. I want to, you know, this whole Israel being the first to officially recognize Somaliland, does this move signal a new era of Middle East meets the Horn of Africa diplomacy, or is Somaliland simply being used as a pawn in a larger game to encircle some of the regional rivals you mentioned earlier?
Well, I think it's a bit of both. That is to say that historically, there have been close connections between the Horn of Africa and what's taking place across the Red Sea and what we popularly refer to as West Asia, for example. You know that I have a book coming out in the fall that deals in part with this story when the Horn of Africa was besieged by slave dealers, particularly from what is now Saudi Arabia, and was ravaged as a result. There were slave markets in Jerusalem, for example. Egypt, which I mentioned a few moments ago, was not only a power that had been colonized by the Ottoman Turks in the 1500s, but by 1882 was under the jurisdiction of the British Empire. But at the same time, Egypt was pressing southward to try to colonize a good deal of Africa all the way down to the equator, to the point, as I talk about in my book, in the mid-1870s, Egypt had recruited a number of demobilized Confederate officers, that is to say, yes, from the defeated enslaving class in Dixie in North America, who then were spearheading an invasion of Ethiopia, of Abyssinia, in the mid-1870s, and fortunately, they were repulsed. So there have been historic connections across the Red Sea, and this latest chapter is just another wrinkle in the story. Now, I should also say that it's quite ominous and dangerous, because given the fact that Israel is backed up by U.S. imperialism, that means it does not suffer from a deficit of arms. And it obviously has an air force that is capable of dropping bombs, as we saw during the 12-day war in Iran in June 2025. As a matter of fact, many of us expected that before December 31st, 2025, that there would be a revival of that the mid-2025 conflict. The only question then becomes, who would the bombs be dropped on? I should also mention another key player in this story, and that is Turkey, the former, or its predecessor, speaking of Ottoman Turkey, being a former colonizing power. For example, Massawa, which is now part of Eritrea, had been dominated by the Ottoman Turks and then by the Egyptians for centuries. Today, Turkey, or Turkey, under President Erdogan, plays a major role in Somalia. It is quite upset with the recognition of Somaliland because it fuels the ongoing conflict between Turkey and Israel, to the point where some of us had suspected that Turkey, despite the fact that it is a major military force, the eastern flank of NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, might come into armed conflict with Israel. And we say that not only because of the fact that Israel has established itself in Somaliland, not far distant from where the Turks have established themselves in Mogadishu, where they're responsible for providing scholarships to Somali students, for providing security for the Mogadishu airport, for picking up the garbage, for being a major recipient of high-level visits from the Mogadishu-based government, et cetera. And so this conflict between Turkey and Israel has not only spread to the Horn of Africa, it's spread to Greece and Cyprus as well. Recall that relations between Greece and Turkey are complicated, to put it euphemistically. Recall that Greece fought a bitter war for centuries against Turkey, and in fact, rather derisively, for the longest period, the Turks referred to the Greeks as little more than slaves. But in the 1820s, the Greeks, with international support, including from the United States of America, and from a number of other so-called Christian powers, because the backstory of a lot of these conflicts is that religion is a motivating and driving factor. And of course, Turkey being a leading so-called Islamic power. And so that conflict has been revived with the Israelis establishing themselves in Athens. The Israelis also have established themselves in Cyprus. Recall that in 1974, that this Mediterranean island was invaded by Turkish forces. And to this day, the island is split between a majority Greek Cypriot population and a minority Turkish Cypriot population, with Ankara obviously ensconced in the latter section. The Israelis have been snuggling up to the Greek Cypriots, which is quite unfortunate. And Turkey has reason to believe that it may be in the process of being encircled. And with this recognition by Israel of Somaliland, not far distant from where the Turks have established themselves in Mogadishu. And I should also mention another factor, which is that the Turks have set up a spaceport in Somalia, because supposedly because Somalia is close to the equator, that makes it quite useful for space shots, for example. All of this is in jeopardy because of this reckless recognition of the breakaway province of Somaliland. And I have not even touched upon the question of the forces we refer to as Al-Shabaab, which have been conducting a kind of insurgency in the Horn of Africa that has reached, you may recall, into neighboring Kenya. There have been allegations, and underscore allegations as opposed to facts, there have been allegations that with regard to these aforementioned fraud cases coming out of Minneapolis that has led to the conviction of about 98 people, 85 of whom are Somali ancestry. The allegation is that some of the money, and the money amounted to the millions, Republicans say the billions, was funneled across the Atlantic to Al-Shabaab, believe it or not. So this is a very complex and complicated story that Israel has complexified further by the reckless recognition of the breakaway Somali province that is Somaliland.
Reckless recognition, indeed. This is Hard Knock Radio. I am Kalonji Changa filling in for Davey D, and we are live and direct with one of our favorite professors, Dr. Gerald Horn. Dr. Horn, you mentioned the Houthis earlier. With 30% of global shipping passing through the Red Sea outposts, how does an Israeli presence in Somaliland change the calculus for the Houthi movement in Yemen and the security of the Suez Canal?
Well, it makes it more complicated. I should also have mentioned in my previous remarks another factor, which is that continuing a historic pattern, the first foreign visits of the Chinese foreign minister has been to Africa. His first stop was Mogadishu. He also visited Ethiopia. In fact, he may even still be in Ethiopia as we speak, if not on his way to Tanzania, further down the coastline of the Indian Ocean to Dar es Salaam. The Chinese leaders, of course, recognize that they are in what might be called Cold War II with U.S. imperialism, but China has more than one card to play, not only because, as we saw at the South Korean summit between Mr. Trump and President Xi Jinping of China, basically the Chinese caused Uncle Sam to cry uncle with regard to this tariff war and trade war by threatening to cut back on rare earth mineral exports to the United States, which are necessary for the construction of smartphones, the military industrial complex, and automobiles. The fact that they had cut back on soybean purchases from US Midwestern farmers, which then caused a multi-billion dollar bailout from Washington for these Trump supporters. And this is also complemented by the fact that the People's Bank in Beijing helps to keep the U.S. government afloat by buying U.S. debt, treasury bills, and with the penchant for cutting taxes on the wealthy in the United States of America, the United States, believe it or not, is heavily dependent upon China to keep its operations going. And so when you see the Chinese leader go to Mogadishu to support the Mogadishu-based government, and U.S. proxy Israel goes to Somaliland to engage in reckless recognition because of the perceived threat from across the Red Sea of Ansar Allah, or the Houthis, as they are popularly referred to, we begin to see the dimensions of a major plot and what might be called Cold War II. Now, I don't think that Ansar Allah will be appreciably slowed down by these machinations. They've proven themselves to be rather sturdy. Recall that in the early days of the Trump regime, 2025, he had pledged to destroy Ansar Allah, but alas, he decided that these were tough hombres, and he decided that the better part of wisdom was to pull back. And so I trust and I hope that our peace forces and opposition forces, particularly in Washington, are paying careful and close attention to this unfolding plot, because Mr. Trump oftentimes is misinformed, ill-informed. I got the impression, indeed, that his knowledge of the Horn of Africa extends no further than the movie Captain Phillips, for example, which is this lurid portrayal of piracy off the coast of Somalia involving so-called Somali pirates. And so, given the ill-informed nature of the current occupant of the White House, it becomes all the more incumbent upon we of the opposition to hold his feet to the fire, to make sure that this seething cauldron of tensions in the Horn of Africa that has now migrated across the Atlantic to Minneapolis does not explode further.
You're checking out Hard Knock Radio here on the Pacifica Radio Network. I am Kalonji Chonga filling in for my main man, Davey D. And today we're talking to Dr. Gerald Horn. Dr. Horn, a lot going on. Wanted to ask, with the 30% of global shipping passing through these straits, how does an Israeli presence in Somaliland change the calculus for the Houthi movement in Yemen and the security of the Suez Canal?
Well, that's a very important question. It's particularly important in light of the fact that the current occupant of the White House is ill-informed, misinformed. He likely gets all of his information about the Red Sea and the Horn of Africa from Captain Phillips, the Hollywood movie dealing with so-called Somali piracy. But raising that question also raises the import of what you just posed, which is that recall that when there was an accident in the Suez Canal, that it caused a rerouting of shipping around South Africa, for example, and it added time and costs to shipping from Asia to Europe and to North America. Let me interject two data points here. One is that in the last 48 to 72 hours on the southern tip of Africa, you have had military maneuvers by South Africa, Iran, China, Russia. Perhaps I should not say military maneuvers. Let's just say maneuvers. And that received condemnation from the White House, no doubt, because they saw it as military maneuvers. And so, in other words, if somehow the Red Sea were to be blocked along with the Suez Canal, once again, that would heighten the importance of the Cape of Good Hope, the southern tip of Africa, now controlled by an African National Congress government, a member of BRICS, Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa, with very negative relations with the United States as we speak. Recall that President Ramaphosa of South Africa was ambushed in the Oval Office by Mr. Trump, along with then first buddy Elon Musk, making spurious and fallacious charges about so-called white genocide. Following that, you might have noticed that there was an influx of the European minority from South Africa into the United States, despite the fact that supposedly Mr. Trump is anti-immigrant. Certainly he makes exceptions. So when you begin to talk about Somaliland, the Red Sea, the Suez Canal, it opens up the question of South Africa and the Cape of Good Hope. And of course, South Africa's complex relations with the United States and their warm relations with Russia, China, and Iran. So certainly your question is timely.
Okay, okay. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. You know, with Iran now a formal member of BRICS, the geopolitical gravitational pull seems to be shifting away from Washington. How does the deepening alliance between Tehran, Moscow, and Beijing alter the traditional U.S. strategy of containment in Yemen? Specifically, do you see the Houthi movement as a local actor being integrated into a broader Eurasian security architecture that threatens the settler colonial interests of the U.S. and Israel in that region?
Well, as you probably know, Ansar Allah, what is referred to as the Houthis, they have been accused of being a proxy of Iran. And it's no accident that as we speak, Iran is in the crosshairs. We have been told that this week, Mr. Trump will receive a briefing with regard to U.S. kinetic action or bombing of Iran in light of the protests that have been going on for a few weeks. The son of the late so-called Shah is warming up in the bullpen, supposedly. He is going to be parachuted into Tehran to take over as the Islamic Republic and their leaders are ousted. This is one of the reasons why the kidnapping and abduction of President Maduro and his spouse was so dangerous, because it gives the U.S. authorities ideas about replicating that particular crime. And let me say parenthetically that I would urge and caution President Petro of Colombia to reconsider his supposed trip to Washington in a few days and a few weeks, because I think we may be in a new ball game with regard to international norms. That is to say, we had thought there was something called head of state immunity, which allows Mr. Trump to visit South Korea and Malaysia without the fear of being detained, despite his many crimes against humanity. But head of state immunity obviously is no longer applicable, as Mr. Maduro now rotting away in a jail in New York City. And it would not be beyond the realm of imagination for Mr. Petro to land in Washington. And right before he lands, there is an indictment from the Southern District of New York charging him with narco-terrorism or many of the other so-called crimes that he is alleged to have been committed by Mr. Trump. And this is something that should be taken quite seriously, just like with regard to the United Nations General Assembly meeting in the fall. I don't think we can assume that leaders from Iran and Cuba can come to United Nations in New York and speak and go back home without the possibility of being detained, just like Evo Morales, then president of Bolivia, was shocked and disappointed when his plane a few years ago was forced down because they thought, or the U.S. thought, that he had whistleblower Edward Snowden aboard. So we can also expect more planes to be forced out of the air. This is the brave new world that we have now entered. And even from the point of view of U.S. imperialism, I think there would be a grave blunder for Mr. Trump to bomb Iran. We know that per the national security strategy enunciated in December 2025, that U.S. imperialism has decided that it's more than a fool's errand to confront China and Russia united. Hence, you see Mr. Trump seeking to back away from the Ukraine proxy war, for example. The strategy now appears to be to attack the allies of China and Russia, which not only is of geopolitical and geostrategic significance, but from the point of view of Venezuela, they feel that it helps to give U.S. imperialism a stranglehold over the petroleum market, the lifeblood of modern economies. But we'll come back to that, because I think that that particular formulation is not going to pan out. But in any case, this proposed bombing, if that is what it is, of Iran, is also going to short circuit the protest movement, because I think there will be a rallying around the flag of those who had been rallying against the regime in Tehran. That is the general pattern historically, that when countries are bombed by external forces, that they tend to rally around their regime. That's why I would say that even from the point of view of U.S. imperialism, it would be a blunder to attack the Iranian regime. But I think that U.S. imperialism feels it's on a roll, it's intoxicated with its own hubris with regard to the abduction of Mr. Maduro and his spouse. They, of course, are still celebrating the weakening of another alleged, purported, supposed Iranian proxy, speaking of Hezbollah in Lebanon, for example. They are still dancing in the streets outside the Pentagon with regard to the overthrow of the al-Assad regime in Damascus, Syria, for example. So we cannot put beyond the imperialists the idea that they might think that they can overthrow the current regime in Iran on the back of these protests across the country in Iran and parachute in Reza Pahlavi, the son of the late Shah. From their point of view, this would also give U.S. imperialism another foothold in the all-important petroleum industry. But there hangs a tail, because as promised, I'm returning to the question of Venezuela and oil. And recall what happened just this past Friday when the CEOs of various oil corporations met in the White House. And the headline takeaway was from Darren Woods, the chief executive of Texas-based ExxonMobil, who says right now that Venezuela is not investable. I think he used the term uninvestable. Right, and right. I think what he is referring to is that Mr. Trump is looking for instant remedies, instant coffee, if you like, whereas investing in the oil industry of Venezuela is more like a 10-year proposition. Mr. Trump will be 80 in June, and it's unclear if he'll be around in 10 years. And in any case, if the chief executive of ExxonMobil goes into Venezuela, where the regime is still intact, the Chavistas, as they are called, and it's unclear whether they'll follow the diktat of Mr. Trump, who told them to turn their backs on Cuba, Iran, Russia, and China. It's unclear if President Rodriguez will follow that diktat. Recall that the Cuban foreign minister was in Caracas in the last 48 to 72 hours, for example. And so even if the United States is able to work out a deal whereby the oil of Venezuela is controlled by the U.S., it's not clear whether or not there'll be a net victory for U.S. imperialism. Number one, it's a global market. If that oil does not go to China per contracts, what that might mean is that China will get substitute oil from Saudi Arabia, for example, tightening the relationship with that erstwhile U.S. ally. And then there are the contradictions in the U.S. base. Speaking of the Shell oil producers, S-H-A-L-E oil producers in West Texas, who are as mad as wet hens about the fact that their competitors and peers will be subsidized by the U.S. government per Mr. Trump's pledges to take oil from the ground in Venezuela, which will be harmful, they think, to their interests in West Texas, for example. There's even been speculation that the tankers that have been hijacked from the waters of Venezuela and taken to the Gulf Coast of Texas, even that oil, given the nature of the global market, might end up in China, for example. And in any case, China is busily and speedily moving along the path of electrification. That's the import of BYD, the Chinese electric vehicle maker, outselling Tesla of the United States in the year 2025, for example. That's one of the reasons why you have the giants of Germany, Volkswagen, BMW, Mercedes, fearful, understandably, that these electric vehicles from China, and I only mentioned BYD, I could have mentioned NIO and Geely and others, will be eating the lunch of the German auto manufacturers, just like they've eaten the lunch of Tesla of the United States of America. I'm saying all this to say that U.S. imperialism is scrambling to overcome the trajectory of history, which points to China being in the passing lane, with U.S. imperialism being a declining power. And as a New York Times writer put it, being forced to move from America first to America's first. That is to say, this reworking of the so-called Monroe Doctrine into the Dunroe Doctrine. That is to say, moving away from, as noted, a frontal confrontation with Russia and China to frontal confrontations with Venezuela, perhaps Canada, perhaps the EU over Greenland, etc. But even with regard to the so-called Dunroe Doctrine, you might have noticed that in the last 24 to 48 hours, a step forward has been taken with regard to a free trade agreement between the European Union and Mercosur, led by Brazil, that is to say, this common market of South American countries, a 700 million strong joint market. And that pact had been in negotiation for 25 years or more, since 1999. But all of a sudden, after Maduro was kidnapped, you saw steps towards ratification. Now, of course, the European Parliament still has to sign off, but it does look like this free trade agreement between Mercosur and the EU will go forward, which is thumbing its nose at the Dunroe Doctrine. It shows how archaic and antiquated and moth-eaten Mr. Trump's thinking is and his strategies are. And so, once again, to repeat, U.S. imperialism is in terminal decline, and it's unclear to me, at least, if there's any way out.
Wow. Man, this is, you mentioned the possibility of a strike when talking about Iran. How would China and Russia, both of whom have deepened ties with Iran, respond to a unilateral U.S. strike? And would this trigger a direct military confrontation with Russia or a total economic decoupling from China?
Well, it's unclear. I think that China in particular sees things going its way. And it recognizes that U.S. imperialism feels that its remaining advantage is in the military sphere. A Pentagon budget of $1 trillion, Mr. Trump says it'll be hiked to $1.5 trillion in the next fiscal year. And even if there is a strike on Iran, a country approaching 90 million strong, it's unclear if that will topple the regime, just like Mr. Trump being alert to the tensions and contradictions within his base has not moved thus far towards regime change. In Caracas, they just removed the leader, for example. So I would urge Mr. Trump, however, to do what he is apparently not accustomed to doing, which is to look at the world as one global village, so to speak. For example, he's bidding fair to blow up NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, by going into Greenland, the island which he sees as being part of the Western Hemisphere, a 57,000 population controlled by Denmark, population of 6 million. He feels, and his aide, Stephen Miller, the Prince of Darkness, feels that it would be quite simple to seize Greenland. I don't think that he sees blowing up NATO as being any great loss. But what it could do, it could totally reshuffle the international chessboard and finally force the Europeans, the Western Europeans in particular, to move away from their three centuries long obsession with toppling the regime in Moscow. They thought that with the toppling of the Soviet Union, December 25th, 1991, that centuries-long obsession had been reached, but all they really succeeded in doing was forcing Russia to stop providing subsidies to Georgia and to Moldova and to Transnistria, et cetera, and husband those resources on behalf of Russia itself, which is still a superpower with a vote at the United Nations Security Council. So if Mr. Trump were to be so audacious and so bold as to launch a military strike against Iran, I'm not sure what the immediate dividends would be. I think that it would lead us once again to revert to history, to what was operative at the beginning of the 19th century, when a number of European nations decided that the better part of wisdom was to unite to topple Napoleon Bonaparte. And of course, Napoleon Bonaparte not only met his Waterloo in Waterloo, he met his Waterloo when he tried to invade Russia. And so you already see rumblings and grumblings in Western Europe. I'm speaking of the EU, about imposing sanctions against US imperialism, about imposing visa and travel restrictions on US corporate executives and those engaged formally in skullduggery, speaking of State Department officials, CIA officials, Pentagon officials, etc. It would not surprise me at all that if Mr. Trump were to be so contemptuous of international law as to go into Greenland, that sanctions would be forthcoming sooner rather than later. And that would be a game changer, because it's not only turning the tables against US imperialism, it's giving US imperialism a taste of its own medicine, because of course it has sanctions against Russia, Iran, Venezuela, Zimbabwe, the list is endless. And this kind of maneuver against US imperialism once again would cause all of us to go back to the drawing board.
Right on. You're checking out Hard Knock Radio. We're on the Pacifica Radio Network. This is Kalonji Changa. Of course, right now we're rapping with one of the greatest historians of our time, our good brother, Dr. Gerald Horn. Dr. Horn, we definitely appreciate you coming on, of course. You know, you mentioned, we talked about Trump and Venezuelan oil, and I know that, and we mentioned Exxon, and Trump is, you know, threatening to sideline Exxon, and, you know, he made a statement saying that they're playing too cute. I want to ask, does sidelining a super major like Exxon risk slowing down the restoration of Venezuelan oil production, and which is currently vital for the administration's goal of decoupling from Middle East energy?
Well, as you know, Chevron is already in Venezuela. There's an article in the Wall Street Journal today, that is to say today, January 12, 2026, about Chevron and its close relationship with not only Mr. Trump, but also Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent, for example. And Chevron, which in the past has been close to former U.S. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice, feels that it alone can take the weight with regard to exploiting Venezuela, I think that Mr. Trump might be overreaching. You might have noticed that at the White House meeting with the oil executives, Harold Hamm of Texas, one of the top-ranked petroleum executives in the United States and a close donor of Mr. Trump's various campaigns and efforts, even he was hedging and ambivalent about going into Venezuela because the numbers basically don't work. I mean, for example, if you posit $57 a barrel for petroleum, a barrel of petroleum on the open market today, and you look at the fact that in Alberta, Canada, which has the heavy and dense petroleum that is the case in Venezuela, taking oil out of petroleum out of the ground in Alberta is about $27 to $30 a barrel, which still leaves a lot of room for profit taking. Whereas as of now, taking a barrel of oil out of the ground in Venezuela is closer to $80 or $80+. So the numbers really don't add up. And so Mr. Trump is basically asking ExxonMobil to go over the cliff with him with regard to thumbing his nose at his shareholders and perhaps at his own bonuses, which are tied to the stock price of ExxonMobil. And it's little wonder that Darren Woods thus far has turned a cold shoulder towards that particular idea. But there's another issue that I'm afraid to say is too infrequently ventilated on these shores, which is, what about the elephant in the room, the dog that has yet to bark? That is to say, Mr. Trump got 77 million votes in November 2024. Polls suggest that on the one hand, two-thirds of the U.S. electorate is against the abduction and kidnapping of Maduro and his spouse, but two-thirds of Republicans are in favor. And I think that too often, our friends on the left, they focus on the former poll figures, but not the latter, which ignores the fact that the Republican Party is the latest iteration of the political representative of settler colonial descendants. And in a settler colonial society, settler colonial descendants have their thumb on the scale. It's just like looking at the politics of Israel, for example, where 20% of the population is of Palestinian and Arab descent. But it's well known that to do anything meaningful in Israel, you don't need necessarily an electoral majority, you need a Jewish majority, and setting aside whatever protestations might come from the 20%, for example. And I think it's well past time for those struggling in the United States of America to take advantage or to take account of that particular reality, for example. As a matter of fact, I'm surprised that in light of the fact that our friends on the left oftentimes apply the descriptor settler colonialism to historic Palestine, but not to North America, not to the United States, I'm surprised the Israeli patriots have not accused us of the left of being anti-Semitic. I mean, it's taken less than that to get them to make that explosive depth charge, for example. And I think that that would then get us into a story that I've written on quite voluminously, which is the origins of the United States of America, how the United States has been the vector of counter-revolutions, starting with 1776 and revolting against British rule, not least.
And we're going to have to end the conversation right there and pick up with part two tomorrow here on Hard Knock Radio. Again, the conversation featured professor and historian Gerald Horn dropping gems, a wealth of knowledge and information on so many variants regarding Venezuela, Somaliland, U.S. imperialism, a lot there to unpack. And we will continue again with part two of this important conversation tomorrow. Now, I just also want to mention for our listening family of Hard Knock Radio, the voice that you've been hearing hosting these past few days have been Kalonji Jamachanga. He will be presenting today in Oakland, California. He is an organizer, founder of the FTP movement, and the co-chair of the Urban Survival and Preparedness Institute. He's also the co-founder of Black Power Media. He's the author of the best-selling book, How to Build a People's Army, and co-producer of the documentary, Organizing is the New Cool. As I mentioned, he will be presenting today at 6 p.m. at BAM House, located at 1540 Broadway in Oakland, California. Again, that's BAM House, that's Black Arts Movement House, 1540 Broadway, Oakland, California. For more information, you can always call BAM House or check out the KPFA website under Hard Knock Radio. We will have a list of today's conversation notes as well as the link to get information regarding tickets. Again, I'm Anita Johnson. We'll check you out tomorrow. Be safe, y'all. We're out.
Everybody, this is Goddess, and she, and you're tuning in to KBOO Portland. Holla at your girl.
This is Bird Note. Hollow bones help birds like this herring gull sail around in the air without using much energy. But gulls resting on the water look remarkably different from the common loon floating nearby. A gull's body rides high above the surface, like a cork, while the loon's back just tops above the water, like a submarine peeking above the waves. That's because these two birds are specialized for very different lifestyles. While the gull is adapted for efficient flight, the loon is fine-tuned for the underwater world. The loon's bones are denser than those of gulls, songbirds, and other expert flyers. With a lightweight skeleton, they'd be too buoyant to dive and chase fish. Instead, loons can kick their powerful legs and webbed feet to swim 200 feet or more underwater. Penguins can dive even deeper. Emperor penguins submerge for up to 30 minutes and can reach depths of 1,500 feet before coming up for air. Dense bodies make these birds poor flyers, or even flightless in the case of penguins, but they are acrobats under the waves. For Bird Note, I'm Ariana Rimmel.
This is Ray Lynn, and you're listening to KBOO Portland.
Is autism an epidemic?